Okay, I think we're right at 4 o'clock, and we can start on time and end on time and be ready to move on with our evening. So I'm Kim Thanis. A pleasure to be here today and have a chance to talk about new economic models and opportunities that we have collectively to make changes in higher education that are important changes to be made. Our panel today is three senior leaders for companies that are doing things differently in higher education with regard to the economic models. And so on the far side is Jeff Shellstad. Jeff is the CEO of Flat World Knowledge. Flat World Knowledge is an open textbooks company, and Jeff will be able to talk about the changes that they are creating in the publishing industry. Lou Pugliese is the CEO of Moodle Rooms, and well known the services that Moodle Rooms provides around providing support and hosting for the Moodle open source platform. Tom Chapman is joining us this afternoon in place of Chris Coppola, who's on your agenda. Tom's the Chief Financial Officer and Vice President of Business Development for R-Smart. And R-Smart provides hosting and support around the Sakai product and the Qali products on the ERP side. So those are our guests today. I want to also welcome the remote audience that is joining us, the online audience that is joining us. So you'll notice through the session that when we're having audience questions or discussions, that I'm going to try to remember, and if you can help as well, to have people move to the mics. If we're having discussion at any point that's not mic'd, then our online audience will not be able to follow along. So please have a little patience with the mic process. So this session, I believe to be an important session because I have the opportunity to work across a lot of different elements of open education and open source communities in higher education. And I think that when we have a theoretical discussion about change in a way that creates economic models, creates savings for institutions, for students, allows us greater flexibility in reallocating resources towards the things that are most important to institutions, that we have a lot of philosophical support for that. And when it comes to actually implementing that kind of change in higher education, it's actually quite difficult. And we end up running into barriers and obstacles that exist because of the history behind us. And so the purpose of this session is to be able to really share perspectives both from the senior leaders of the companies as well as from all of you around how we can collectively make greater progress. So, you know, why is it important that we make progress in this area? We look at the size of industries that we're addressing. About $20 billion a year are spent on textbooks for the U.S. in higher education. If we look at the ERP spending, $2.7 billion a year spent on ERP systems in education in the U.S., $1.2 billion spent on the learning management system across the U.S. So we look at those numbers and say, those are significant amounts of money at a time when I think we would collectively agree that education is underfunded. So how can we actually realize those savings? I'll borrow a quote from the very dynamic Brad Wheeler, who is the founder of both the Sakai and Qali communities. And Brad would argue that, you know, we always want to talk about our money problems. He'd say, we do not have a money problem. We are awash in money. We have a coordination problem. We're not using our collective power to bring together the money that we have to solve the problems that we need to solve, to put those dollars where they have greater benefit for learning. And so that's what this focus around a change in economic models really is to say, how do we look at the spending that we're doing and how do we identify new models that allow us to collectively make that kind of shift? So with that brief introduction, I'd like to just give each of the panel members a moment to speak about the kind of economic models they're trying to put forward and the case for change about for in each of these areas, why this makes sense at this time. So Jeff, do you want to start with that, please?
Sure. So Flat World's mission is to break down the barriers between the publication of high-quality higher education content and the use of that content. So if you think about the textbook market, as we all might refer to it, there's obviously two core customers, one, the first being the faculty member who's the gatekeeper and usually decides on what is being used for content in the course, and then, of course, there's the student who pays for that choice. and so if you look at the kind of the argument that Flat World's making around the business model or the economic model for those two customers, on the professor's side, our argument is basically First off, you should take a step back to use any content, so you should expect good content. But the notion of it being yours to control is a game changer for you. So the notion of an open license, which these two individuals have practiced to my left on a different platform, is really a disruptive or new play in the higher education space. Of course, on the consumption side, on the student side, who's paying for that choice of a textbook, the biggest barrier you can break down is of course, cost. And we do that, again, in a very disruptive way. We let all of our learners in for free to a web-hosted book. And the argument there is learning only takes place if you have access. And if you lock students out of access, which some are unfortunately locked out due to cost or whatever, you affect learning. And so, you know, later on I could talk about some case studies of places where just letting students into the content changes course completion quite dramatically.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, I think, you know, from my perspective in our business, you know, we obviously leverage open source at that in a way that has pretty profound, you know, economic impact in the industry. From the perspective of really, you know, what do institutions get in terms of time to value? So, you know, in the proprietary world, significant investments go into developing a proprietary platform. It's a very supply-driven formula. You know, proprietary vendors build it, you buy it, and you write checks, big checks in some cases, to support it. And so the scale economics of the open source, proprietary versus open source, is really distributed economics from a crowdsource perspective. So, you know, the ability to be able to gain much more quick time to value in terms of transitioning an entire, in our case, an entire enterprise scale learning management system from a proprietary platform to open source, because it's a cloud-based environment and because it's a, you know, a shared economic model where you're not paying huge upfront premiums, you know, for hopefully long-term value. It changes the whole game plan in terms of a shorter period of time to implementation, lower cost, lower ongoing cost from economic perspective. And so, you know, it really changes, you know, the whole environment when it comes to, in our case, a demand-driven environment where the community itself is determining how the platform is built, how the platform is used, what the education community wants, how the education community shares and interacts with both content and technologies. You know, from my perspective, you know, having run proprietary businesses before, this is actually my first open source business that I've run. I don't have to run 300 programmers in my organization. In fact, I probably only have 9 or 10 because I just, you know, basically use those programmers to enhance the Moodle experience and a services model that, you know, that you know, creates value, you know, in a shorter period of time. So the economics are basically passed on, you know, to the end user customer. From a cloud-based perspective, to be able to deploy in a cloud on pennies on the dollar and not have that show up on the checks that all of you have to write, I think changes the entire, you know, economic environment of open source, in our case in the LMS industry. So that's how we see the industry evolving. That's the benefit we think we've been able to experience and share with the education community.
Just to play off that a little bit, at R-Smart we're focused both on the Sakai community and the Kuali products and their community. Just the lower economies of collaboration that are available to institutions today, we've been able to prove out on the Kuali side the ability of those institutions to come together, drive a product at an enterprise scale that really meets their needs and is focused on their piece and allow R-Smart to be a strong partner and play an appropriate role there, as opposed to play the role of really driving what the product should look like from their perspective.
Thank you. So I have a few questions that I thought I would go through with the panelists. We have time for you to ask questions as well, and then we also have some questions of you. I think it's unrealistic to believe that economic models can be changed only by the providers or only by the buyers. that, you know, collectively we have to make change. And so, you know, there's some of what can you do to help support that change, and that's what our panelists can share. And then we would also like to hear from you. So as you're listening to their responses and thinking about, as you've been trying to make change given budget constraints and the challenges that are very real for all of us right now, what can we do to better support what you're trying to do on your campuses in terms of the right kind of economies, the right kind of vendor partnerships, and what does that look like? So I'm hoping we'll finish today with a bit of a dialogue around both how you can help support this kind of change and how we can help support the changes that you're trying to make as well, and do that collaboratively. So I thought it might make sense to start with some examples of progress. So rather than kind of the theoretical models, what are some of the examples of places where these economic models are having really positive results in making change? Jeff, do you want to start again on that one?
Sure. So I'll just highlight a couple of examples. One is a couple years old for us now, in the sense it's one of our earlier users across a pretty broad institutional adoption. And then I'll highlight one that's just recently closed, which kind of dovetails on a person that Kim mentioned earlier on. So the first is Cerritos College, which is a pretty traditional community college outside L.A., urban community college, older student body, lots of English is second language students, and lots of issues of affordability. And 2.5 years ago, their business school ran a pilot with one Flat World textbook in the Introduction to Business course. And what they found is, again, just the notion of access for those who weren't consuming. Lots of distance learning students at Cerritos, so lots of students who don't get on campus much, don't have access to the bookstore, all the typical issues. But with us, with a free web-hosted book and a variety of other formats that you might consume for a fee, everybody had access day one of class. And the president, Linda Lacey, wrote an article in Community College Weekly at the end of that term that basically said, hey, we found our solution for the issue of learning, and I'm maybe overstating it slightly, but basically 10 to 15% higher course completion rates in one course, Introduction to Business. Cerritos now uses about 12 of our textbooks in a variety of courses. So great example of what access can do at a place like Cerritos College. Indiana University, to dovetail on Kim's comments about Brad Wheeler, so Brad kind of pooled his resources, CIO at Indiana, 109,000 students across 8 campuses, and said, I want to help provide transparency into this content industry and help change it. And so he pulled his resources and went issued an RFP to the industry and said, listen, if you want to play with us going forward, here's some of the terms. But what I'll promise you in return is I'll promise you 100% sell-through of students in a course, which the industry struggles with, right? The industry gets about 55, 60, 65% sell-through in a typical course, if they're lucky, sometimes much lower. and so Brad said, I'll guarantee 100%, but you got to play along with me. And so you might have saw the announcement a couple weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago now, where Indiana announced a deal with 5 publishers, 2 of the major ones noticeably absent, where, you know, the typical student will be paying about 35% of the list price of a typical textbook at Indiana going forward. And so it's a game-changing type of implementation that somebody led on campus, took the bull by the horns per se, changed a lot of the fee models on campus, and is introducing a very kind of modern way to deal with content at scale. So a very potentially laudable example.
Great, thank you. Go ahead, Luke.
So, there are a lot of examples. I'll point to one, the Louisiana Technical Community College system. You know, in Louisiana, where all of the entire system was on multiple different types of learning management platforms, was interested in moving into the open source environment, and very high cost, in terms of the development of instruction, instructional materials, because they were on different systems, didn't have a real way to sort of share, create content across a network, create derivative products, derivative courses, across an entire network, and didn't really have a method for getting everybody on the same platform, on the same page, and moving in the same direction in their e-learning strategy moving forward. So part of our business, obviously, is trying to solve complex problems and moving from large platforms, proprietary platforms, to the open source, in doing that in a very scalable economic way with as few obstacles as possible. And there It's never a seamless process. So, you know, fast forward 1 year, a significant number of courses converted from native applications, created an interoperable platform that could easily plug in third-party applications, created an entire social network within that institution, exchange content across the entire technical community college system. The rate of instruction in terms of the cost of instruction and creating courses, you know, goes down significantly. The cost of the platform itself in terms of moving, you know, off of multiple different platforms into one platform that's, you know, in the cloud, more than a 35% cost reduction that they can now roll into, you know, the instructional development or the academic side of the business instead of having to support multiple platforms, you know, in the proprietary world. You know, significant rate of change, very quick, time to value, short period of time, and a significant community that was built within that, with that environment, all organic, all viral, you know, with an open source community. So it was a good opportunity for us to prove out, I think, some of the value that open source brings.
So if I focus for a minute on the quality side of our business, really when we got, joined that community, it was really with the vision of being able to drive some of the cost out of that side of the institution at the administrative level, move it over to the learning and the education side. We've done that early on with Colorado State as an adopter, publicly stating, you know, their ability to reduce their cost of implementation and quality by $5 to $7 million. The unique aspect of the quality product, though, is also being able to drive that down to a smaller institution like Stevens Institute of Technology, and in a hosted environment for them, produce a product that the much broader market can take advantage of. They haven't publicly stated kind of their total savings, but if you'll talk to them, you'll hear them say that they've got zero license costs. They've got implementation costs that were slightly lower than they would see with others, and perhaps more importantly, an efficient implementation and ongoing support costs that are comparable to what they've been providing so far. So I think the new aspect of that collaboration is an area that we are focused on.
Great. So beyond the successes, what are the obstacles? What is making it difficult for these kinds of changes to take hold, and what stands in the way? Tom, do you want to start that one?
I think for us, it would start with the procurement process, actually, and just the idea that with open source software, you can start with actually using the software and evaluating it yourself rather than quickly going to RFP and creating structures that are very rigid and don't allow you to fully evaluate your needs first and then understand what solutions are available, how they might best suit your needs.
Go ahead, Luke.
I think some of the obstacles are, and I would actually characterize this as you know, somewhat of an opportunity, is, you know, we tend to, we find that institutions tend to look at how they are looking at change, whether in their early, you know, learning management system or adopting new content options, new digital content applications, or even, you know, in Kuali's case, you know, a new ERP system, from the perspective of where they have been in the past as opposed to where they want to be in the future. And so oftentimes we look at what we really need today in the here and now as opposed to what are the changes and the profound economic challenges we're going to have in the future, and what do we need to do today to make decisions that are going to be persistent, you know, over the next, say, 5 years or even a decade. You know, do we really want to go over a wholesale change of our learning management system again at the end of a 3-year contract? So, you know, my sense is that, you know, we need to look at a broader vision of the future of what these institutions are going to be and how they're going to, you know, to evolve over time and make decisions based on that, as opposed to what we've done in the past of worked and what hasn't worked.
So in the content space, there's obviously not much of a contractual lever, right? So, I mean, faculty are kind of free to change anytime they want their course materials. That said, most don't. Most stick with their current assigned textbook for quite a long time, usually on average about 6 years, a couple of editions minimum. There is, of course, a pretty clear moral hazard problem in the industry in the sense that, you know, faculty member has complete control of selection but doesn't pay for anything, and that creates an obstacle, of course. I think we face a general, you know, kind of lack of depth of catalog because we're a new publisher. We only have 45 titles published. We have an awareness issue generally. But, you know, our best advocate is our most trusted advocate, our most trusted referral is obviously another faculty member. So it doesn't take long for us to pick up one faculty member at Ohio State who has a good experience with our projects and shares that amongst their own community. And that's the best way for us to market is really peer-to-peer. We try to enable that in as many ways we can, but that's really fundamentally our challenge.
So, Jeff, why don't you follow that on with, if you were to request one change or make one recommendation that would help them help with that process or help move things ahead, what would you ask or what recommendation would you make?
Yeah, I think, again, I don't want to turn this into a Bread commercial because that's not the purpose, but I think, you know, I think leaders on campus creating a forum for discussion is really important. So it's almost an education process for faculty. I mean, they, you know, faculty have lives and responsibilities and lots of things going on, and at least for us or for, you know, for them, a textbook selection isn't something at the front of their mind every day or every even every term. So, you know, I think creating that environment of education, of information, what's going on in the space, you know, for example, I'm going to Ann Arbor in 10 days to present to a large group of faculty that the library is hosting all around the notion of open education. And those kinds of platforms are informative, we hope beneficial to the institution, and certainly, of course, we hope beneficial to us long term.
Lou, what would you request in terms of a change that would help facilitate or smooth this process?
So, you know, I think, you know, I would actually ratchet the conversation up to a higher level and, you know, kind of paraphrase by a conversation I had with the Department of Education, you know, a couple weeks ago where, you know, they were going around venture forums and talking to companies about what do we need to be doing better at the department level to enable change in institutions. And in this particular case, what I was sort of recommending was, you know, legislation even in ways that would enable institutions to actually fund initiatives that make them much more efficient in the way they operate. And so, for instance, one of the recommendations we kicked around was, you know, what if over a period of time you actually incentivized institutions to demand from proprietary software vendors to offer not necessarily premise-based solutions or a migration path off of premise-based solutions into the cloud, for instance, in ways that over time they get significant economic benefits. You know, so in our case, you know, we can basically provision, you know, an individual website with a full course environment for, you know, pennies on the dollar. Just think how much money can be saved over time. But I think institutions have to be enabled to do that. And so why don't we have, you know, some legislation or some experiment project that allows them to be funded in ways that will, you know, enable change more quickly and incentivize them to reduce their technology expenditure and run, the, you know, run that into, you know, the academic side of the equation.
Great. Thank you.
And just to play off that, I think it's the combination of the leadership that Jeff mentioned along with those types of incentives to really address what is a change management process and being able to embrace that with your entire organization and work through that in a way that you know, has that longer-term vision as opposed to trying to run just a brief, discrete RFP process, for instance.
Yeah. So I think I'm only supposed to moderate and not answer my own questions, but I do have to make one pitch for a suggestion that I would have, showing poor discipline as a moderator. I work with a lot of companies around kind of trying to shift models around collaboration and with the communities themselves. And one of the areas where I see incredibly high cost and investment that no one wants to make is in the area of sales and marketing. The more complex the process becomes for you to make decisions and engage with vendors, you know, the more cost is drawn away from innovation and from support and from honestly reduced prices that make a difference. And so I do think that it is that it's easy as you look at procurement processes that have been in place for a long period of time or adoption models that are the status quo to move that along and even perhaps enhance it and find an even more creative set of 753 requirements for the gradebook. And yet, all of that comes with such a significant cost that we all collectively share. And so, you know, really focused effort across higher education to reduce cost of procurement would result in better solutions at lower prices. And it's a difficult one to take on, and yet if each institution takes the work of peers and ratchets it up one notch in terms of the level of complexity of some of the procurement processes, then it becomes a downward spiral for all of us. So with that little pitch, I would love to hear from all of you as you think about the changes that you're trying to make and both the opportunities and the challenges of trying to adopt some of these new models. What do you run into, and what could we do to help with that? Please go ahead, but I have to ask you to come up to the mic first, if you don't mind, just so that those online can hear your comment or question.
I think one of the things that institutions are challenged with when looking at open source or community source solutions is the risk analysis process in the procurement stream and understanding what the metrics are that we can use to reliably assess institutional risk when considering these product lines. Do you have any good examples of how that's been conducted with institutions?
Well, I would just jump in. I think the opportunity with the open source solution is to actually engage with the software and actually use it before the as you go through that risk analysis and go through a proof of concept in a way that's much more flexible and open to your needs, much more affordable. And just that open access alone should go a long way to allowing you to assess that risk in a way that traditionally you've not been able to do.
So I think I would answer that by, you know, first of all, we have, you know, risk analysis information and tools and use cases and other types of resources to evaluate risk, various different criteria in which to evaluate risk and how that's applied against different use cases. We can certainly get that information to you. But I think if you look to the general consumer market and look at parallel types of applications that have been in the market for a long period of time, you know, you're pretty much going to find the same kind of parallel of the same types of risks that you're weighing now. So, for instance, if you look at the history of Linux, right, and other types of applications that have been thoroughly tested in the market, both, you know, in a pure open source environment and an open source support environment with companies like Red Hat, I think you'll find some very, very strong parallels for things for you to look for that also apply to your institution. And there's a lot of data and there's sort of a lot of science between that risk analysis in very, very large scale, you know, in terms of Linux obviously being an operating system, but you're talking about numerous other applications like, you know, Apache and, you know, other types of applications that have been in the market for a long time that are very, very similar to the kinds of things that you need to consider. And there is data, there is research in the marketplace on those types of risks, and, you know, we'd certainly be able to give you information from our perspective as well.
You're there in the back, do you want to, or I think we have someone at the mic right now. Please go ahead, and then if you don't mind coming forward to the mic, and you can go next. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for being here and talking. And thanks for being here in business, because I think it's a win for all of us that you folks are in business, and as I suspect many of us in the room, I'm a customer of at least one of you. And one thing that would be really helpful to us and that I would like to hear your take on is a really clear statement about how you're going to make a profit and stay in business while adding value both economically and philosophically to this open source platform that you're working with. Instead of competing with it. And I think there's a tension in that you want to improve it. And I think I'm new to Flat World, but I know that R Smart and Moodle Rooms have actually added a lot of value back to the community. And so help us understand that long-term trajectory.
Sure. So I guess I'll start by saying, you know, the economic model for our business is very different than a proprietary system. You know, I mean, we, as I said earlier in my earlier statement, you know, this is an organization that can support a wide scale of institutions at a very low cost of goods. And the reason we're able to do that is because, you know, 70% of our application is not something that we own and control. We improve it. We put code back into the community. We are actively involved, you know, with the development of the product. We're very close to Martin DeGiamis in our case. Speak to him every week. Co-develop products together. But because it's a shared economic model, we don't have the cost structure that any organization would have. I think we get further benefit on the scale economics of the cloud. So, you know, commodity cloud environment, the per unit cost of an FTE to deploy an entire website, you know, goes down by every 1,000 or every, you know, 150,000 users in our case. We can shave off a couple of pennies per student. So, you know, the fact that, you know, sort of like fractional ownership on a jet, I mean, is, you know, the more you scale the institution, the more cost efficient it becomes. And so the cloud economics allow us to really operate very cost efficiently. We're in the cloud. We can, you know, obviously not have to go on premise to deploy anything. You know, when I was working for proprietary course management systems in the past, the ratio of services representatives to number of institutions was roughly about 1 to 8. You know, I had to have one person dedicated, or two in some cases, to a full implementation of a premise-based solution. In our case, you know, it's roughly about 28. So that's a very profound, you know, cost structure, lower cost structure in which to be able to operate in. In an open source community, the profit is not, it's not necessarily a huge profit, and it's more of a margin motivator for us than it is a profit motivation for us. So our business is really in trying, you know, to grow, sustain, and make scalable an open source, you know, open source community, and we can do that with fewer headcount, fewer software tools. We'll continue to invest, you know, in the software enhancements where obviously our expenditures come in, but frankly, where most of my investments have been really are in the support structure, right? And there again, we don't necessarily have to staff up, you know, at scale from a proprietary, you know, service. So, you know, these are very complex problems that people need help with in moving from one environment to another, especially an open source environment. And so most of the investment, you know, we've invested millions in people, you know, having strong implementation people, strong professional services, gold standard support. And I think in the end, that's how you pay it forward. That's what's essentially going to make this business successful, is really moving institutions from one platform to another, being very good stewards of the growth and development and long-term success of their open source platform.
I think from RSmart's perspective, it's allowing us to play the right role in the process. I think in the past with commercial vendors, you see them playing a number of roles that move their alignment away from being well aligned with the institution, whereas in the open source community, it's much more aligned. We're playing a role in driving a profit in an area that makes sense, as opposed to trying to drive extremely high margins in something that the institution's been locked out of and can't have control of.
I mean, fundamentally, our economic model is, of course, very different, and of course, we're not an institutional play wholly yet. I mean, most of our business is a one-off faculty member with 60 students is our typical installation, and maybe, you know, a couple of those on each campus. but since we're not a legacy print publisher, we have very high margins. We're digital first. Our margins on most of our sales approach 75% gross margins. So, I mean, it's a very strong, you know, kind of business digitally, and we don't have to, we're not trying to protect a legacy print business that's generating, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue in the case of the places I left. So we're not profitable yet. We're a traditional venture-backed industry, or company, I should say, but we're heading towards profitability here in the next 18 months or so.
And Jeff, do you want to just, I'm assuming there's not as much familiarity about your business, do you want to just share what your pricing structure is and how that works?
Yeah, so I mean, we have a number of pricing structures, but most simply, we let every learner in for free, and so that's the unique piece. Everybody has access to a full web book that, you know, kind of never goes away. It's always there and always free and always accessible. But then we let them behave like consumers and consume any other format they might want, be it print or EPUB for various tablets, or audio, or Mobi for the Kindle, or print-it-yourself PDFs, or any study aids. Those are all choices the consumer, the learner, makes. Our average consumer spends about $33 when they purchase. You know, only a little more than 40% of students actually purchase from us. The other 50-plus percent stay free. But when they purchase, they spend about $33 with us in various mixes of print and digital.
Do you ever sell color print textbooks?
Now, for every 100 print textbooks we sell about a half of color. Nobody buys color when they aren't forced to. So, so we don't sell many color textbooks. We'll have to actually probably eliminate them, yeah.
Go ahead, Bruce.
I'm Bruce Taggart, Vice Provost for Libraries and Technology at Lehigh University. And more of an observation than a question, and this was kind of brought up yesterday at the CIO meeting about Qawali. A lot of the driving factors for a lot of our movements to open source is not exactly economic, but it's just a lack of a product within the proprietary market that's meeting our needs. We moved to open source, you know, course management a couple years ago because we really didn't see a strong alternative in the market. And so we went that way, and the risk was added value to our course management system. And so there wasn't much risk there once we saw what we could do either with, you know, Sakai or Moodle. It's the same thing with the library world. You know, we've had for the last 7 or 8 years, and this was stated by Michigan State and I think by, you know, others, that with the lack of a natural market, you know, improved product, we're looking at open source. And luckily we have a community behind it. I mean, the library world, just with this Olay project, the timing was really opportune for a lot of us, because in the absence of that, you know, we've gone out for the last 10 years to get a value-added product for libraries, and there wasn't one. And we heard that from several institutions. And with textbooks, we're looking for the value add to improve, you know, added, you know, animation, simulation. The lower cost is just a bonus. So it's more of an observation. I think things are moving really well. The economics is great for us, you know, especially in the open source world. If we can then develop this stuff and then down the stream, it can benefit a lot of other institutions where they could download it and then use all the other expertise of the development. So just kind of a comment.
Certainly ask you a question. So in terms of the open source environment, is the fact that you chose open source because it provided features and functions, or what it might be the proprietary vendors did not, is that because of the community contributor model? Is that because the community was actually saying, this is what we want and this is what should be developed?
Right, because it was the community was saying that, and it was, and it wasn't, you know, Indiana was involved, but it was mainly from institutions such as Chicago and Duke and Lehigh and Florida. These are private institutions who, you know, we do have the economics to go out and buy, you know, products, but in the absence of it, you're right. So it was more of a community-based, need-driven development project.
So that's really interesting, and this is where I think that the whole supply and demand, you know, free enterprise is going to change a little bit, and we're hoping that long-term open source is going to be more sustainable, because people are voting with their wallet, you know, but they're also voting with their head and saying this is what's missing from the industry, and as a result of an open community contributor model, you know, we're actually developing products and services that are sustainable and scalable and replicable in the marketplace. So we're hoping that it's, you know, this trend continues.
Yeah, there's an interesting market dynamic. Casey Green's presentation today around the LMS market share. So, you know, the shift in market share this year, Blackboard lost about 7% market share, and between Sakai and Moodle, I think picked up 6 of the 7. And, you know, there's a difference in the market dynamic when you look at the investment models of institutions, because if I'm a commercial traditional commercial software vendor, the closer I get to kind of the cap on market share that the market's going to allow me, my disincentives to innovate just completely fall away. So, you know, that innovation has to drop in order for me to sustain my margins, because I'm really not driving more new revenue based on those innovations. And if you look at the growth in the Moodle community and the Sakai community over the last few years, as new institutions come into the community, they bring new contribution. And so as market share grows, the pace of innovation actually increases, and there's a greater diversity of investment in those communities. So it's just a kind of an interesting, I believe, as we start to look at, because still, you know, Blackboard is still over 50% market share. And so from just a pure academic perspective of studying this change in our industry, I think it's not yet apparent how that kind of growing market share of these community source and open source projects plays out. But that's certainly something that I think the next 2 years there will be some interesting stories to tell or analysis that we'll be able to do around that kind of shift of innovation given that market share change. There you are. I'm sorry, I lost you once you moved forward and couldn't find you again for your question. Please go ahead.
That's fine. I'm wondering what your thoughts and maybe recommendations are on the intersections between organizational culture and open source software, whether it be, I think maybe I would say the open source model in general, whether it be open content or open source software, because we found in our experience that by and large there are many cultures that are not conducive to such thinking, not conducive to the community contribution model, the open content model, even the free model. When there's no vendor behind it, there's nobody to call, a lot of traditional IT cultures get uncomfortable. Have you experienced any of that? And if so, what are your ways, what are your pitches, what are your thoughts around that?
Well, I think I would say that that's kind of why we're in business. You know, we're there to bridge that gap and to make open source software as easily consumable as it has been with proprietary vendors.
Well, you know, I think our from the perspective of the kind of feedback that we get, you're either dealing with one of two types of people or institutions. One, the first that is, you know, very nascent market where they're saying, well, what is really open source about, and you know, how do I download it, how do I use it, and is there, you know, really cost and some suspicion. I think that's waning, you know, largely in the marketplace. And, you know, the other side of the equation, you know, understands open source free like, you know, a free puppy, you know. And so, so they're pretty, you know, they understand, that it's not actually free, but they're also very much in the dark in terms of what's needed to be able to support it, what types of services you should provide, what are the open questions in terms of how the architecture can scale, you know, what's the security scheme, is all those things that are sort of a mystery you kind of have to demystify. So more and more of our work is more in the demystifying some of the, you know, some of the unknowns as opposed to dealing with institutions that are, you know, kind of cutting their teeth first time on the open source environment. So
when I left Pearson with my colleague to start Flatworld, certainly we did not have the notion of open in our vernacular. I mean, Pearson was not doing much of that at the time. And so, you know, it wasn't until we started to learn about OER, open educational resources, and then started to challenge ourselves to come up with a business model and a sustainability model around it that, you know, got interesting. And I think over since we launched publicly in March of 2009, I think we've worked really hard to, in some ways, separate ourselves from the OER marketplace that predated us by 8 or 9 years, because there was a lot of skepticism about the consistent quality and the completeness of those materials and the adaptability, really, the faculty scale around use of those types of materials. So what we've tried to enumerate in the market as strong as we can is we're a publisher. We follow the same practices as the places we left, but we attach an open license, and here's what an open license can do for you, faculty member, and your students. And so I think, you know, I mean, one of the things that really helps us in that regard is who we start with as an author, right? And so we have a number of authors at Lehigh, but we have one, Jack Lulley, in media and communications, and nobody is going to accuse Jack Lulley of doing a bad book, right? I mean, he's just a really respected scholar, and so his book just recently came out, and And that gives us tremendous credibility immediately in the space. We don't have to explain what Luli's doing. It's Jack Luli, so it's an acceptable piece of content. It just happens to be openly licensed, and now let's talk about what that does for you.
All right, any other questions or requests?
Go back to one point that was brought up earlier. It seems to me at 100,000 foot level, we're talking about a change management process here. And I wonder, do you feel it's a positive or a negative or neutral, in essence, the shared governance model that exists in most of the providers that you're dealing with, the university and college system that we represent?
I think that's for you, Luke.
That's for me. I'm trying to think in my head to reiterate the question, so it was pretty complex questions. I think, from our perspective, I think the shared governance model is really all about education first and foremost, right? And so it's, you have to develop a whole education program around, the whole notion and ideology around open source. So you first, obviously have to educate, and I'll say a pretty bold statement, that I think, the ideology of a proprietary software is fundamentally broken, right? So you have to start from that, from that premise, and then you, start sort of the education process by saying, your next statement is, the great thing about open source is that it's open source. The worst thing about open source is that it's open source, right? So there are certain risks that you have to mitigate going along with that, and hopefully over a period of time and through an education process, you can mitigate, how that shared governance model actually works and operates, and get people to accept the general ideology, from the start. So that's part of the upfront challenge that we have, I think.
If I can just add one point to that, looking across, having worked with Jeff and with Arshmart, and watching the Moodle community very closely, and particularly true, I would look at some of the early adopters of Qawwali or the early adopters of OpenText. And in spite of the shared governance model, it almost always starts with a champion, with kind of one believer. And so coming back to from some of the themes of the keynote that kicked off the conference, of the idea of, don't underestimate the impact of one individual that sees what is possible and is able to build a little bit of support and where that can go, because in almost every case, that does end up being the model that starts with a single champion. So, go ahead.
My question has to do with some of the innovations you're talking about. You mentioned how it provides access to more people and things like that are maybe in the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. At what point do you think, or will there ever be a point where some of these innovations sort of go mainstream in terms of either become such a compelling value proposition that people, can't help but adopt them, or on the other hand, just the whole $40,000-$50,000 a year college experience becomes unsustainable, thus forcing these things to be adopted? So when will it, are we near that, or 5 or 10 years from now, is it going to be sort of still a nibbling at the margins type of thing, this sort of innovation, not only yours but other changes in the way higher ed operates?
Well, it's a good question. I think, from my own perspective, I think, we reach critical mass in this marketplace to the extent you can significantly decrease per unit cost of instruction, at the same time, on a corollary path, increase student retention and persistence by 20%, right? And so that's going to prove itself out over time if we're able to get, to that level of acceptance and, pure unit economic scale. And I think we're starting to get there now. I think data will show, over time, that I think we're on a trajectory that will prove that out.
All right, we are at the end of our time. Thank you so much. Please don't hesitate to come up and take a moment with the panelists if you have other questions or comments. Appreciate the discussion that went on here today. Thank you.